Our speaker, Dr. Oliver Grubner, is a health geographer who combines methodologies from geography and epidemiology to assess population health risk. He earned a PhD in geography from the Humboldt University in Berlin, Germany. Currently, he's at the Epidemiology, Biostatistics, and Prevention Institute at University of Zurich, Switzerland. So please join me in welcoming Oliver.
Thank you so much for coming, and also so much for inviting me to come here to present my research today. I'm very glad to be here. So my name is Oliver Grubner. As you heard already, I'm currently with the University of Zurich in Switzerland, and the presentation that I'm giving you today is based on past research that I did based on data collected by the Harvard Center for Geographic Analysis. And I'm looking forward to give this talk. So today's talk is about, I will first start setting the context, telling you a little bit about what I consider of being spatial and digital epidemiology. I will give you some rationales for the application of social media and geo-referenced social media data in the post-disaster mental health context, and then I will provide you with three examples, and if we have still time, then I will also aim to provide some outlook where we can go from there. Excuse me. So what's epidemiology? And I think some of you might know that already. It's basically the science of understanding the causes and distribution of population health so that we may intervene to prevent disease and promote health. And this is based on the book by Sandra Galea and Catherine Keys. So there are actually three things to it. The first thing is it's about the distribution of population health. It's about the causes of population health. And it's about something that we can do about it. In terms of interventions. So in analogy to this, I defined spatial epidemiology as the science of understanding the spatial distribution of population health and the locally specific causes so that we know where to intervene to prevent disease and promote health. So actually, three important points to it: the spatial distribution of population health, the spatial distribution of the causes, and so that we know where we may intervene, right? So then there's an additional field of science that has been emerging recently, and this is called the digital epidemiology. And I base the definition of what we consider digital epidemiology is based on the paper from Marcel Salaty, also a colleague of mine in Switzerland. He proposes a very simple definition of it, that's epidemiology that uses digital data. So that's not quite helpful in that regard, because for a long time we already use digital data in public health and epidemiology, so this is not really getting to the point. So he proceeds to further proposing epidemiology as a field that uses data that was generated outside the public health system with data that was not generated with the primary purpose of doing epidemiology, right? So leveraging data that was collected without the purpose of doing public health research. So it's about new data sources induced by the digital revolution. It explores avenues, data sources that can enrich epidemiology. And it includes data like search engines, social media, mobile phones, website access, etc. So here in this talk, I'm going to use social media data from Twitter to actually answer the question whether we could leverage social media to identify mental health risk in the population. So, as I said, the data is coming from the Harvard Center for Geographic Analysis, and it's about georeferenced tweets. So I guess you are all avid Twitter users in this room. If you are not, this is how it looks like. A typical tweet consists of text, which by that time was limited to 140 characters or less, includes URL links, hashtags, and emoticons. Nowadays, they increased, and just recently, actually, Twitter increased the space to 280 characters, so that is a little bit more space. But since these studies are based on data that is from 2012 and also from 2015, we are dealing with 140 characters. So that, just you know, that is very short text, abbreviated. And it also contains a geolocation. Okay, so it contains a geolocation and a time and date. And additionally, you could also lean on information on the username, on probably there's a photo and a link to a user profile. So in general, you could extract at least 38 data features that are available from this kind of data that you could either directly assess or relatively easily extract from these kind of information. So for this talk, I'm basing on the information given by the text, by the geolocation, and by the time and date only. Okay, with a lot of potential to do more. So the research scope in which the whole talk is embedded in is that traumatic events can have substantial consequences for population mental health. And by traumatic events, I mean terrorist attacks or natural disasters, where there's quite a large difference between the both, because terrorist attacks have the additional dimension of intention to it. So for natural disaster, you can get prepared. For terrorist attacks, not so much. here's the state of the art. What do we know about post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic mental health problems? For example, we know that early emotional reactions predict long-term mental health problems after disasters. So if you, the intention and the intensity the emotional reactions and the intensity thereof that you have and feel during a disaster is actually related to what we see afterwards. So if you see someone dying next to you, and this creates some emotional reaction, and the more intense that is in terms of negative experience, that creates the higher risk for problems like depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. We also know that data from social media could help identify populations in need of short-term relief during and after disasters, so there has been a broad research body about that, using, for example, Twitter data to know where something is happening or how can we identify people in need, but not so particularly so in the context of mental health. And there's also something called the automated sentiment analysis that could extract specific emotions from these data. So this is not new, because linguistic models are out there for quite a long time based on text data that extracts emotions and sentiments based from text data. But now there's a kind of reinforcement with the availability of social media data, which has the additional problematic that it's very terse, short, abbreviated slang text. But these, there has been done a lot of studies about that, and it's quite working quite well. And then there's another thing called space-time syndromic surveillance that could effectively detect disease clusters in different contexts based on different data, but not so much on social media data. So, at least to my knowledge, no academic efforts identified areas of particular pronounced emotional reaction as a way of anticipating post-disaster psychological need. And such an approach could help to rapidly identify excess risk of emotional reactions following traumatic events, so that we know where we may intervene to prevent consequences of disasters. Another problem that we see in these traditional studies and traditional surveys is that they are most of the time event specific after the disaster has already happened. There are a few exceptions, but the general problem is that we don't know where this disaster is happening, so we go there out in the field only after the disaster had happened. So this is potentially missing crucial information on the time during the disaster and a baseline before the disaster, so that we know about the emotional reactions as they are experienced during a disaster. So coming to the example, this is the first study we ever did with this kind of data, and it was around the terrorist attacks in Paris in 2015. And we were thinking about a proof of concept study for a space-time syndromic surveillance system of post-disaster mental health. So two specific goals here. We would like to classify specific emotions based on recorded Twitter data for over 3 days from 13th to 16th of November in 2015, and to detect clusters of excess risk of these emotions. The sample consisted of Twitter data which were geo-referenced within a 15-kilometer radius around central Paris, November 13, 6 a.m. in the morning, until November 16th, 7 a.m., 2015. And this actually provided us with around 28,000 tweets. we could only use tweets that were either in English or in French. We identified that by an ensemble vote based on statistical machine identifiers and translations, and translated that then later into English tweets if they were French. And as I said, the source came from Harvard. Here's a little slide on how emotive works, which we use to identify single emotions out of these tweets. So emotive stands for extracting the meaning of terse information and visualization of emotion. And here's the typical tweet text, which then is analyzed by emotive. And what happens is first the text is segmented into different objects and identified whether there are some emoticons like smileys or whatever. And then it's categorized according to what it actually is. Is it a verb or a proverb or an adjective or whatever? And to which part of the sentence and sentence itself actually it belongs. And then if that is identified, then it's held against an ontology which contains over 1,000 emotional terms, intensifiers, conjunctions, in order to evaluate whether there's a specific emotion according to Ekman. And Ekman has defined six basic emotions like anger, disgust, fear, happiness, sadness, and surprise that are cross-culturally valid. So you can see that independent of a specific culture a person is belonging to. And additionally, emotive is also available or able to identify shame and confusion and the strengths of this emotion. So then, having done that, we used a cluster detection and mapping methodology. We used SATSCAN, which was identified or developed by Martin Kulldorff here at HMS, and which is quite established in the public health sciences to detect clusters. We used the space-time permutation model and sliced the data into 30-minute time frames. And later then, we used quantum GIS to map the found clusters and the significant point locations. Coming to the results, first, emotive identified every emotion actually in the tweets, and here's what they what has been found. More interesting is the SatScan results. Actually, we found fear and one fear and one sadness cluster. So in total, we found two clusters of emotions. And the first cluster was fear. It had a radius of about. It had a radius of about. I don't know what's going on. 2 kilometers. It started November 15 at 1 o'clock, and the same day until 20 or half past 8. It contained 13 cases where 2.2 were expected, and it exhibited a risk of 5.8 inside the cluster versus outside the cluster. So when you were inside the cluster tweeting specific texts, then you were 5.8 times higher at risk of having a fear where there's outside. And then there's also the other sadness, the other cluster that was sadness cluster, which was a little bit bigger, about 7 kilometers in radius. It started November 15 at 4 o'clock. It also had 13 cases, and the risk was 7.3. And we also could identify a false positive cluster, which was actually someone, one single person staying at home and tweeting all the time about his favorite television show. So this was labeled as a false positive cluster. So here are the maps for the fear cluster. This was actually in the area where these terrorist attacks had happened, and fitted quite nicely in the temporal and spatial time frame when these attacks had happened. So the attacks had happened on Friday, and the cluster was then later on a Sunday when people came there to mourn for the victims. And the other cluster was slightly bigger. This is the map for the sadness cluster, which you can show here, and which also included the terrorist attack sites. The discussion for this particular study is that specific emotions could be classified from tweets in the given area and time. The clusters of excess risk of fear and sadness were detected actually around the attack sites of the disaster, and responses reflected the processing of fear by users who were in the area, assuming that the attention to potential threats is elevated in the aftermath of such a disaster. And one interesting point here is that the time frame of the fear cluster overlapped with an incident in which a firecracker was heard shortly after 6:30, close to Place de la République, which created a mass panic, and then this was reflected in the fear cluster. And we could also verify these clusters, as we could always go back to the original tweet texts to see what has been tweeted about after they had been identified belonging to a cluster. So this was the discussion for this particular study, and the limitations here, which also refer to the other studies, are that we used only English and French tweets, but the majority of the tweets in this area over the study period were in these languages, so we don't think that these things created much bias here. We only used the text. We could also use the images posted and other things, social networks and things like that. We also used only the georeferenced tweets to identify who was there at that particular moment. But we need to keep in mind that this data is not representative of the total Twitter population in that particular area during that time frame. We just used the univariate scan statistics, so we didn't adjust for any potential confounding variables. And we used a 30-minute time frame. And if we had used a larger or smaller time frame, the clusters would look like a little bit different in size. So for the example two, this is also about using this data in the context of a surveillance approach. This time in the context of a natural disaster, Hurricane Sandy. And the research goals here were to identify specific emotions in tweets for the greater New York City area during Hurricane Sandy, and to detect and map clusters representing excess risk of these emotions. So again, we used georeference Twitter tweets. This time it was about 423,000 tweets that were identified as English tweets in the study area over 2 weeks. So we used a 2 weeks time frame from October 22 to November 4. Hurricane Sandy made landfall in October 29. And extracted specific emotions on these tweets, as you have seen in the other study. Then again, we use space-time scan statistic with a permutation model, and this time with a 1 day time interval. And again, we use GIS to map the outcomes. So here's a map showing all the tweets in the study area, and you see that it's covering New York City, the five boroughs, plus parts of New Jersey, so a wider area, wider New York City metropolitan area has been covered, and you see that there's a lot of tweet activity close to the JFK airport, where people, when they land, tweet that they are now landed or something like that, right? So you would expect a lot of tweets there in Manhattan and other areas as well. So emotive here gave the results that we could find the most prominent emotion given as sadness, then disgust, and I think it was surprise. Yes, disgust, sadness, and surprise were the most prominent emotions found in this 2 week time frame during Hurricane Sandy. And here's a graph that shows the temporal distribution of these emotions over time. And you see, it's quite interesting because people were prepared in this 2 weeks time frame. So they were very well aware that a hurricane called Sandy is coming close. But still, we see a very high tick here of surprise, actually, when the hurricane made landfall on October 29. The other emotion, which was actually the highest, was sadness. Up on the top, and fear that was elevated during, you cannot see that very well, but fear was also very elevated during the event. So coming to the cluster maps, and I focus on these three emotions as they were most prominent in these in this data. So fear and was very much prominent in Manhattan. And Satskan returns clusters according to their significance and their most likelihood. So the most likely cluster Satskan, the spatial temporal scan statistic, identifies is cluster one. And here you see that cluster one is in this area, starting at October 26th, so directly 1 day before the hurricane made, oh no, it was a couple of days before hurricane made landfall, and then lasting until the very same day, or the very same day before the hurricane actually made landfall. And this is, you have to imagine that a hurricane date when the hurricane makes landfall in 29 is not the only event that happens. So there's a lot of flooding going on right before, because there's high pressure moving water into the area. There's a lot of strong winds surrounding the time when actually the hurricane makes landfall. So this very much makes sense. And we saw in the tweets themselves that people were afraid of shaking windows close to their in their offices, or they reported about do not go into the parks, there are trees falling and wood flying around and things like that. So the next emotion was surprise, and this is the cluster which is most likely, or the most significant cluster actually, on the day of arrival when the hurricane made landfall, which makes also kind of sense, because the disaster, or the Hurricane Sandy track, was actually coming from the sea towards Manhattan, and Long Island was hit the hardest, or part of the hardest. Yes.
What's the significance of the size of the circles?
It's actually the radius of the whole cluster. Yeah.
And so the larger ones are.
No, it doesn't have to do anything with the significance.
So significance is completely separate from that.
Yeah, exactly.
So cluster one and two are highly significant, or at least cluster two is highly significant, but very small spatial footprint.
Yeah. So the size doesn't mean anything in terms of significance.
Okay.
And then the third cluster which was found was sadness, and we find the sadness cluster, the most likely sadness cluster here, also in Manhattan, which was just on the day after Hurricane Sandy hit the area. So, conclusions for this would be that emotions could again be quantified and mapped in space and time. And in general, for these surveillance studies, both examples showed that a space-time syndromic surveillance system may detect emerging population risk of mental health consequences of traumatic events. It could be refined and prospectively applied on real-time social media data. It could assist in long-term allocation of service post-disaster, and it may have potential to guide emergency care and rescue efforts in areas without emergency infrastructure. So here's my third and last example, which is also in the context of Hurricane Sandy, but now over a longer period of time. So now we are dealing with 6 weeks. And this is not particularly looking at a surveillance approach, but on a more analysis-driven approach. So this is called the spatial temporal distribution of negative emotions in New York City after the disaster. Here, we try to identify geographic distribution of emotional responses in Twitter before, during, and after Hurricane Sandy. And we combined specific single emotional reactions into one signaling or identifying representing discomfort. Then second, to identify spatial clusters of discomfort. Third, to investigate associations of discomfort over time, and then assess the geographic variation in these associations over time. So first, we used again a different level of analysis. Now we are dealing with these data at the census tract level, and only for New York City census tracts. So we cut out the New Jersey area and focused solely on the New York City area. We also used emotive in English tweets, and we identified that pre-disaster time slices of approximately 2 weeks. There were about 400,000 tweets. Perry disaster, there were about 235,000 tweets. And post disaster, there were again about 380,000 tweets. Okay, so the sample was slightly different across these time frames due to several circumstances during the disaster. You can imagine that there were service outfalls, power cuts, and things like that, which were hindering people actually storing or charging their phones or using the network. Then for the cluster analysis, we used global and local Moran's I. We used a spatial regression model with a spatial lag on it, and we used a spatial regimes regression approach. Outcomes here, this is the distribution of DISCOM4 across the New York City boroughs, and what you see from this is that Staten Island had the highest levels of DISCOM4 over all periods of time. So even in the baseline before the hurricane, people were complaining or publishing negative emotions in this context. And this was also reflective somehow in the spatial clusters that were found the largest in Staten Island. If you are not familiar with these kinds of maps, red means high values of DISCOM4 close to other high values in that particular area. So it's a cluster of high DISCOM4, particularly in Staten Island, that is clearly visible pre-disaster, during the disaster, and post-disaster. Post-disaster is also interesting that this area, which is also quite exposed in Brooklyn, also exhibited a cluster of negative emotions expressed as DISCOM4. Then coming to the associations of DISCOM4 across time, we found that pre- and peri-disaster DISCOM4 was actually associated with post-disaster DISCOM4. So if people were in that area kind of unsatisfied due to whatever reason, that increased the likelihood of also being unsatisfied or feeling DISCOM4 also after the disaster. But this association is the global association and was not equally distributed across space, which was then associated with the spatial regimes modeling approach that can disentangle the different associations over the boroughs in New York City. So we found different associations, association only in Manhattan, the Bronx, and Queens, where peri-disaster DISCOM4 was actually associated with DISCOM4 after the disaster. So key findings and key challenges for this. Basic emotions could be identified from Twitter, indicating this time DISCOM4. Spatial clusters in DISCOM4 were found before, during, and after the disaster, and pre- and peri-DISCOM4 was actually associated with post-disaster DISCOM4. These associations were geographically varying across the boroughs, and we see that there were infrastructural damages that actually limited the availability of the tweets during especially the disaster, which I said was due to the case that there were power outfalls or service outfalls in the areas. Of course, we used just English tweets, and there were also other languages in the area spoken, so we could have implemented that, but this is a limitation. We didn't do that. And there are likely movement patterns which created possibly, or which contributed also to the distribution of these clusters, like people traveling from their home place to a shelter to receive food or whatever relief, so that this could have potentially biased our results. So I would like to give you an outlook. This is what we have done already, and we did not touch yet, the case that social media itself could potentially be problematic for mental health outcomes or for emotional reactions. So we know that at least about 90% of young people use social media. It's linked with increased rates of anxiety, depression, and poor sleep. It's also known that 7 in 10 young people experience cyberbullying, and it's considered more addictive than cigarettes and alcohol. So this hasn't been touched yet at all by our studies, but we need to be aware that these things are also influencing what we see in social media as outcomes, right? And a conceptual framework for this would be based on the health map, which I show here, which is adapted to also respect online factors. So we have different kinds of social media platforms that have different features. We have just looked so far at Twitter, but people are using also other social media platforms, and this contribute to also different dimensions of how this is affected to mental health and well-being and emotional reactions. So it also could be that the social network that you have online could positively or negatively contribute to your mental health and emotional reactions and things like that. This is the part for the online factors. And you also have, of course, the offline factors. So where people live, are they in the context of disaster more or less exposed to particular environmental problems? But also on their real social support, on local neighborhood socioeconomic status, and all these things should be considered. And one way to do that is over these activity spaces. So activity spaces allow us to link both worlds together. And I can show you here two maps in the context of Hurricane Sandy. This map is showing a one single Twitter user who was active in Staten Island. And every small black dot is representing one geo-reference tweet of that particular person over time. And by applying some clustering methodology, we can filter out the noise so that we can identify specific activity spaces that are significant to this particular person in a particular time frame, so that we can say at these three locations, these are most significant to this particular person. And then when we lay over a map like from Google, we can easily identify that this is a residential area, this is a college compound, and in the middle we have some shopping area. And together with the time these tweets are usually tweeted, we can easily infer that this is the home location, the college location, and where this person goes shopping. So this is a way how to integrate the offline and the online world all together. In general, I would say the benefits of this approach would be to document emotional responses over time, to identify hotspots in space and time, to detail associations of emotions over space and time, and to track groups at high risk. So now I have two more slides, if this is still within the time frame.
Sure.
which I would like to share with you. This is a current project that we just started at the University of Zurich with the help of you guys to collect geosocial media data for Europe over 5 years, 2014 to 2018. And this project aims to actually enrich these tweets with emotive, like the specific emotions, and also what we can do right now is also to identify stress in this data, and then to set up a repository for the enriched geosocial media data to provide and to provide geographic information on a website so that we can do research directly based on this data. This is not research per se, but really a project that would allow us to build upon, to do research. And for this, and also for the Sandy project, you're highly invited to contact us for collaboration. A particular problem here is ethics, which, or in the whole context, ethics and privacy rights. And we hope to clarify that with our data and ethics professional at the University of Zurich so that we can really get started with this analysis after an ethics protocol has been developed. We face some problems for this particular data. This is really the last slide now. because we see that in 2014, we have around 440 million tweets identified in that area, with a sharp decrease to 38 million tweets in 2018. And this has to do something with the geo-referencing by default that was taken out by that time on around 2014, so that by default is non-geo-referenced. So people that led to a drop in geo-referenced tweets that we can actually identify. And since we only get the IDs, it takes us a couple of days to actually go back to Twitter and download the full tweets. And I posted here the number of days, how long it would take us to download the tweets that we already got from you. So in total, for this part, for this kind of data for Europe, we would need around 86 days, nearly 3 months, to download the full data set to work with, given the restrictions by Twitter, because they only allow us to download such an amount of tweets in a particular time frame. Good. So with this, I would like to thank you for your attention, and hope that we are still somehow in time, and I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
Question. In your Manhattan Sandy study, did you, I know one map, you said those are the total counts. Was it per track, total count per track, right?
Yeah.
So when you do the clustering, did you consider the percentage of tweets with certain emotion definition versus the total tweets in that area? Because you could have a cluster of any emotion just because that's a hotspot to send out tweets.
Exactly, yeah. So it's always, we're talking always only on proportions, like the emotions divided through total tweets in this particular area, when we are working at the census tract level.
Okay. And also, do you follow the Twitter person by ID?
Not yet.
Time.
Not yet.
Because I noticed that in your map, there are some areas really facing the brunt of the storm, yet their discomfort level, yeah, actually dropped after the disaster, is it because people moved out?
Yeah, there was a lot of.
Or is it because they are happier?
Yeah, that there was a lot of dislocation attached to that,
mm-hmm.
especially in this area where
mm-hmm.
where
right there.
Hurricane Sandy hit the hardest
mm-hmm.
and destroyed a lot of things, including the transit infrastructure and all this. So people had to evacuate, and were dislocated.
Or they lose power; they couldn't charge their phone; they
exactly.
can't send out anything.
So this is a good point, and we didn't get there yet to really, it's just the three analysis that we did so far because of lack in time and research funding money, but this would be the next thing to go. So we just started with this at the very high level. So we didn't even look at in particular persons over time. And this is also something that I'd like to add here. We managed to download all the tweets of all persons that are still using Twitter in 2018 so that we could follow those people who were actually present during Hurricane Sandy in New York City up to now, and with the aim to investigate how their emotional reactions and if we ever get there to also evaluate whether they develop some kind of a depression based on what they tweet and things like that. It could be potentially possible to identify symptoms of depression from that data, which has been done in other studies, so we could do that here as well. And the big advantage is that we have this data and we know that these people were exposed to that particular hurricane. And you could then look at accumulating factors over time due to their mobility patterns, whether they had to be relocated, what kind of other resources there are in their neighborhoods. Things like that can be studied, yes, and would be really interesting to see. Who was first?
Okay. I wonder if you have done or are planning to do anything about the reliability or confidence on the Twitter data, because there are some false accounts I know this is a really serious issue. For example, in a disease, people are not falsely expressing their feelings, but for example, in a case of a terrorist attack, there could be really false news or like false tweets that to trigger people or try to increase the tension in the area, so that can leave some of the outliers in the data set. So I wonder if you have done anything.
Not yet. So the thing is, you would have to have the original content producers in a survey or in an interview, one-to-one, and then try to evaluate what has been automatically extracted from their data, and then retrospectively ask them how they felt in the situation in order to do a validation study. You would really need to have the original content producers in that survey, and I'm really looking forward to do that. But it's a difficult undertaking actually to get funding for this, because one ethical question here is how to approach those people, given that they were already identified as kind of producing negative emotions in a single time frame, or how would you then talk to those people, inviting them for an interview? So I'm not quite sure if we can make that based on this particular data, or whether we need to come up with a total new data set where we recruit people based on other factors and then ask them to also share their social media profiles to do a validation. Apart from that, Emotive has been validated very well. So they did all these kind of stuff already. So this is a different part of research that is done by Martin Sukura's group in Loughborough University, who actually developed Emotive. So this is evaluated. But but not in that particular context of Hurricane Sandy or the Paris attacks. And then I'm also wondering if bots are producing georeference tweets. I may defer this question to Jeff, or do you have any experiences with that? Did you do an analysis to identify bots in your data?
No analysis per se, but I do remember looking early on at Twitter data and seeing all kinds of tweets in the ocean at regularly spaced intervals, which are, I believe, some sort of buoy or some, some locational device that's sending out information. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any other.
Yeah, it's impossible for, you know, cruise ships or any real person to be in that many locations across the ocean. So it has to be some noise or some maybe bot.
Good point, yeah.
So what sort of interventions might be possible, or might this sort of research lead to? I mean, you mentioned, yes, getting someone to volunteer to submit their tweets, but what about when you're taking, 200,000 tweets during a storm and you're finding hotspots? Have there been anything about if there's any possibilities for...
So there are a couple of possibilities to intervene, given that people subscribe to a specific survey service about that. So using emotive in that very context could help in making people aware of their emotional reactions to just inform about their, what they do. This could be something for the particular content producers, so that they are aware of these things. You could provide guidance, what's happening in the area, spatially integrating other sources of information in a geographic information system for that particular person in need, but also for rescue squads and like all these people serving in a disaster event, to identify places of risk for something that's going on. Like if you see a cluster of emotions in real-time live data, then you could point to this on a map and inform official resources to go there and see what's happening, and also further analyze, do topic modeling on what's actually being discussed in that area. Things like that could be possibly working, and there are a couple of things being done already in this regard. So here was another question, yes?
Yeah, so my original question was similar to hers about the validity of the measurement, right? So how can you be sure that what you're measuring is measuring what you want to measure, right? I.e. the actual emotion, perception of the emotion that, disaster survivors or, residents in Paris are experiencing, right? But you mentioned that there are several validation studies for emotive, right? So I think you're gonna need to do more, validation study, but at least there are some validation studies, so I'm working with that. But my second question is that if your goal of this study is to, identify sort of hotspots, right, of negative emotions after traumatic events, since you're using data from very narrow and special population, which is Twitter users and who, use Twitter with geolocation, right? How can you generalize that, the findings from your sample to the larger general population?
Yeah. So the question is whether we want to generalize at all. Because it's we face a lot of problems in generalizing, because we're just using the Twitter population, which is per se a very specific kind of population, and then based on the georeference tweets, it's about from a study in 2015, they evaluated who's actually using georeference services, and this was about 3% at all using these kind of georeferencing services. So we are really talking about a very tiny percentage of the population at all, right? So I don't know if we really can be representative. But here is a but, because it very much depends on the level of analysis. So if you are working on how Wendy proposed on the particular Twitter user level, so you might gain a lot of more information about particular users, being well aware that you're just talking about this very specific subsample, yeah, that you can, you know, like analyze what kind of factors that these outcomes produce. But you would always be just representative for this tiny population using geolocated Twitter tweets. If you're working at a different level of analysis, say the census tract, yeah, and you see that there's a cluster of something going on at the census tract level, then you could assume that also non-Twitter users might be affected by this particular thing, what's going on, right? So this might mean that you cover a quite bigger population living in that particular area where something is going on, and in that particular study of the terrorist attacks in Paris, also we could not directly establish the link to this firecracker. It was really coinciding with this particular event that happened. You know, like people went there to the places, so it's not a surprise that we see an increased risk for sadness at these particular people in these particular places where people came to mourn for the victims. But surprising or interesting is that we can actually measure that. Yeah, and then when this and people were aware of these things, discussing these things that just happened 2 days ago, and then all of a sudden a firecracker was heard, and they didn't know that it's a firecracker. They just heard a large noise, right, creating a mass panic, which was documented in all larger media outlets. And we could see that in Twitter. So it's not surprising that people are fearing that there's something happening right now, but it's really interesting that we can actually measure that. And this potentially affects also people who are not actually tweeting in that area.
I think just to follow up on that, this is a very interesting discussion, but I want to point out, like you showed the drop between before 2014 and after,
mm-hmm.
how many are harvesting, had captured, because the devices suddenly, because people becoming more aware of locational privacy had made the software developers to turn off the GPS tracking by default, and individual user had to go in and turn it on if you wanted to get it on. So before that, you could say that we harvested more tweets from those users who didn't really pay too much attention about the default settings. They may not know it was on and they didn't care, right?
Mm.
But afterwards, the tweets were from people who really want people to know where they are.
Mm.
So those probably has some skewed representation of the population, user population as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And of course, you know, people who use Twitter versus don't use Twitter, that would be one example. Would be perhaps Twitter wouldn't be a very good a source of social media to keep track of people who have depression or severe depression. I'm making this up, but I'm thinking if you're severely depressed, you probably wouldn't be tweeting around.
Yeah,
and then people know where you are too.
But actually, it's the most used resource in this kind of studies. For the sake of availability,
exactly.
And it's not that they are working on the georeference tweets; they are just using all the
mm-hmm.
tweets. And what they do is identify people who tweet that they were diagnosed by their doctors with this particular condition.
Okay.
And then the subsample is created like this, and then they compare the language of this particular sample where there's the others. And there are some clear significant differences in the language.
Oh, so to pick up the signals.
Yeah.
Or maybe a temporal analysis could help too. And then progressing into,
yeah.
you know, the mood, you can see the mood change and
mm-hmm.
and indicating the early onset of,
mm-hmm.
of the stress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank
yeah,
you.
I think it also relates to what you said about the age range because
mm-hmm.
what the teenagers or like the age range that you showed, I mean, they are more willing to tweet or post anything, whether they're depressed or they're happy, so they would like to share anything. And but I agree, Wendy, on not using just Twitter because I mean they could use Instagram or like I don't know if people are still using but Snapchat or Facebook, so they may have post to anywhere. So
absolutely,
it will also increase
yeah.
The data that you can get.
Absolutely, yeah. So. The only thing is that we need is funding. You know, like this is the data which we have and where I based my studies on so far. But absolutely, I agree with you. And it depends on the study design and the research question at hand. And if you are looking at what factors cause mental health problems, compared, you know, like whether offline factors moderate the online factors, which could well be, you would need a total kind of different study design and not using just only Twitter data, but also whatever, what else is available. But you need to develop a total different study design for this. Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of potential. And we're just at the beginning.
Did you include any other interactions, like when tweeting or favorites? Like, I mean, maybe sometimes you have expressed your feelings not on your original tweets, but on the tweets of other people.
So interactions with other, with the social network, actually. We didn't touch social network analysis yet. This is a good idea, and I also plan that, of course, but not yet done, because we are just looking at the tweet level per se and at the neighborhood level. Now the next logical step would be to go on the individual user level and then also evaluate their networks, how well they are connected in terms of their social network online. Yeah, and then you would try to find a way how to contact them and also to ask them how well they are connected in the offline world. And all these things is very interesting. How many followers they have, how many they follow, and things like that. How important they are in their particular network. And yeah, absolutely. Good.
Okay. Well, thank you very much again. Very interesting.
Thank you so much for your comments and suggestions. Great.